Take a network break. Brush the falling leaves off your virtual donut and join us for a conversation, analysis, and a hint of snark. We've got stories today on new ASICs, growing support for Microsoft Sonic, and a trio of FUs. First, let's do a little business. Thousand Eyes, they give you performance visibility from every user to every app over any network, both internal and external, so you can migrate to the cloud, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experience. You can sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and snag yourself a t-shirt. Today's show is also sponsored by CDN77. CDN77 is trusted by the European Space Agency. They support the latest tech innovations and provide fast, secure, and reliable content delivery all around the world. You can learn more at cdn77.com/packetpushers. Last but not least, stay tuned after the news for a sponsored conversation with Arista Networks, where we talk about the value of good software and how it affects day-to-day operations and your security posture.
Good show, too. I was in the recording for that one, and Doug Goulet, who's our guest, knows his stuff, and he's a great speaker as well. Good fun, but also useful content in there. So stick around for that.
Yeah, that's right. All right, let's start off with our FUs. We got a few here.
Yeah, Seton wrote in. He said in episode 251 of the Network Break, that would be nearly a month ago by now, I think. He says, when talking about the Comfold acquisition, Cisco's HCI stack was incorrectly explained. They don't rely on NetApp, EMC, and others for the storage layer on the HyperFlex product line, which is Hyperconverged or HCI. They acquired SpringPath after a long OEM contract. Today, they have totally their own storage solution for HCI. That's quite correct. Yeah, when I was talking about Cisco and Hyperconverged, I was more talking very generically. So I just regard Hyperconverged as Hyperconverged, and Cisco's got, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 different flavors of HCI products in there. So I would refer to Hyperconverged products generally and not the Cisco in-house HCI products specifically. Though I do agree it's very confusing and it's easy to get the words mixed up because who even knows what Hyperconverged stands for these days anyway.
Right, and I do remember covering the SpringPath acquisition. So, but yes, we appreciate the clarification.
Yeah.
The second follow-up, not really a follow-up, just an insight. We were making some jokes about the VMware keynote from Pat Gelsinger, who just happened to mention how he gets up at 4 a.m. talking about that kind of behavior, and somebody wanted to write into us to tell us apparently there's something called a chronotype personalities and different kinds of chronotype personalities, and he had some insight on what that means.
He's a subscriber to the view of chronotype personalities, where there's your mental attitude determines some of your physical attributes. And there is a type of chronotype called the lion, which gets up before dawn and represents about, you know, some percentage of the population. So there's a YouTube video, which he sent us in, which is quite interesting to watch. If you're interested in that, go and check out the show notes to get the link to YouTube. I did watch the video briefly, but I'm kind of, my sort of little antennae for pseudoscience popped up a little bit. And it's got this sort of like the alternative medicine feel to it, a bit like
a little bit of crystal healing in there.
Yeah, well, no, maybe not, but you know, there's that personality type stuff which was valid in the 1950s, but was pretty solidly debunked in the 1970s. But everybody still goes around talking about being an ILNP type or whatever it is. You know, that sort
sure.
of stuff.
There's all kinds of different personality matrices out there that you can subscribe
so
to.
I didn't really want to invest the time following up on that, so have a look at the video, but maybe some caution when approaching it and doing some diligent research in the background could happen. But,
be interesting to see how it affects your search algorithms, YouTube surfaces up to you.
Yeah, but thanks for letting us know. I appreciate that. More information is always useful, but you know, people who get up at 4 a.m. do like to humble brag about the fact that they get up at 4 a.m.
It's true.
Yeah.
All right, we also had a third FU follow-up along the lines of, we were talking about why should I care what we purchase and do inside your organization if my employer doesn't care about doing the right thing? And this person had some strong feelings about that.
Yeah, he was sort of pointing out your company does care. It cares enough to hire you and expects you to work in the best interest of the company and not yourself. And at best, this attitude is unethical and is more akin to taking a step into the realms of corruption, bribery, but covering it up better. Strong words. But I guess what we're getting into here is there's a very thin line between doing your job and caring about your professionalism. So my point would be is that you would always need to be professional in your work, but be aware that your employer and the views of your employer or the position of your employer as expressed by managers or executives who are hired, in theory, to reflect the opinion of the company does not necessarily have the same goals, viewpoints, or morals that you do. Mm-hmm. And morals is increasingly becoming a big issue. So, for example, the right technology solution that would be, you know, something that is widely regarded as the correct way to do something is not necessarily the one that's chosen by the business, or the right moral choice in many situations is not one chosen by the business. And that is not necessarily something that you agree with. That's more what I'm thrusting at here is if your employer doesn't care about doing the right thing And that may be your opinion of the right thing. That may be an entire industry's wrong, but you do. That doesn't matter. Your opinion doesn't matter. It's what the company wants. So be careful not to over-rotate on what you think is right, but do be professional about your job. Do what is asked of you. If the company says this is the way the task is going to go. And in the case, keep in mind too, that when the company makes a decision or makes a choice, it's usually just people. Companies are made up of people. So it's a much more gray area. But when you're hammering through at 120 words a minute in a 30-minute podcast that you're trying to cram into, sometimes we glom over these things. But I would urge you to consider that companies don't care. They are like machines. It's like saying the car you drive cares about you. It doesn't. People do care, but it can be easy to confuse those things. Don't anthropomorphize the system or the car or the tool that you're using.
Or the organization, for sure.
Yes. I personally have found that being somewhat cynical about your work is a survival trait that's let me stay in enterprise IT for going on 35 years, and that is no mean feat.
That's all right. Well, we do welcome your follow-up. We'd love to get clarification, commentary, responses to the show. You can go leave comment for us at packetpusher.net/FU. Keep it nice and simple.
And we'd love to hear. And of course, anonymity, you don't have to give us your name. You know, if you give us an email address, we can get back to you. And it also helps us to sort of decode whether you're serious about it or whether, you know, sometimes people just drop some fairly brutal stuff in there, but that's okay. That's part of the game.
We can take it. It doesn't hurt. All right, let's get to the news portion of the show. We're going to lead off with Mellanox. They announced that their SN2000 and SN3000 switches are now supporting Sonic. Sonic is the open source NAS originally developed by Microsoft and now part of the Open Compute Project.
I'm really inspired by this. Sonic started out as a shim layer or software that was to sit on top of the APIs to talk to the ASICs, and it's increasingly turning into an entire operating system. That's my recollection of this. And I think it's really good to see that this continues to iterate gradually. And I like to read this as gaining momentum, don't you think?
I think so, yeah. When it came out in two pieces. There was Sonic and then Side, the switch abstraction interface, which, as you said, was an abstraction layer to talk to the ASIC. And then the Sonic had some of the networking components on top. It's a modular architecture. The switching components are in containers, so you can upgrade or modify individual components without having to blow the entire OS, that kind of thing. We've seen the uptake. Microsoft originally rolled it out to help scale out their Azure Compute platform and then turned it over to the Open Compute Project to the wider community to say, hey, if folks are interested in this, let's contribute to it. Mellanox has been contributing to it, and I think they see an opportunity there to move some more of their switches.
Yeah, which is really quite useful. I think it's a bit like Linux in 2002, you know, sort of does its thing. What it does, but it's not widely useful for most companies. Mm-hmm. But I'm hopeful that over time it will turn into something that's suitable for use in the enterprises, unless you can. It doesn't have the features. It's still a very limited feature set. So if you can go and make use of the feature set that's in there today, and if you're a cloud company and you're building an underlay and you've got some other overlay over the top, Sonic is worthwhile. Just think of all the cost you can avoid by having an open source operating system, right?
Yeah, my initial assumption in reading the press release from Mellanox is that, of course, they want to get some of that Azure infrastructure money, but they specifically call out in the press release that they are targeting tier 2 cloud providers, telcos, and large enterprises. And for that large enterprise segment, they're offering a combo called Sonic Starter Kits that includes sample switch configs, topology guides, and Ansible scripts. So they're trying to make it easier for folks to adopt this.
What they're saying is people who've got the tech support. So you need to have, you know, Linux experts, you need to have an SDN controller. You're not going to be able to, you know, jump on here and configure it with a CLI. You're going to need to have some tools. So for those people who know what they're looking for, this is where Sonic is going to be. And that's what Linux was doing about that time frame, right? You know, if you think about, remember in the early 2000s, people were compiling the kernel themselves from you know, hand rolling all it. And, you know, 10 years later, look at what you've got. I'm hopeful that this is where Sonic will head over time, and that would be good news for everybody, I think. Not everyone needs a proprietary operating system. There are some use cases where just having something is enough to solve the exact problem.
And just a reminder, we've talked about the network operating system market is changing dramatically. There are tons of open NASs that you can get on a variety of white box switches, and point in case, Mellanox already supports other network operating systems, including Cumulus. Yeah, so there you've got more choice than you could ever imagine.
Surprising number of choices, and I think that's going to continue, to be fair.
Yeah. So. All right, we've got more news to get to, but just a quick break to tell you about ThousandEyes. They help organizations deliver business-critical service by providing performance visibility and actionable intelligence from every user over any network to every app including Office 365 and Salesforce. They have cloud agents, enterprise agents, and endpoint agents to gather unique insights on network behavior, topologies, and how they affect application performance. They also have visualizations to help you break down complex performance issues across networks you own, and more importantly, those that you don't, so you can reduce troubleshooting time and pinpoint root causes. They can generate performance data through active monitoring techniques from their global vantage points. They can correlate multiple layers of data from L7 to L3. They can pinpoint the root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, and more. You can share these event dashboards, metrics, and visualizations with your vendor partners and customers so that you can work together to resolve problems faster or reduce your mean time to innocence. And here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. Snag yourself a free Thousand Eyes t-shirt. Thousand Eyes, thrive in a connected world.
Good stuff. Quite like the Thousand Eyes stuff overall.
Yeah, and just, I guess, a little extra promotion. We just did a sponsored podcast with them about their new synthetic monitoring capabilities, along with a couple of other interesting subjects. So check that out. That's in the heavy networking.
Yeah, there's some days you just want synthetic monitoring. Some days you want passive monitoring. Some days you want probe monitoring. And increasingly, they're covering all those bases, so you don't have to make a choice.
Yeah, but we also talked about internet outages and some SD-WAN stuff, so check it out.
I always love a good use case. I love customer stories.
Speaking of SD-WAN, Ariaka, you may have heard of them. They provide a global SD-WAN service that runs across their own private backbone. They're rolling out a new option so that customers can use local internet connections that don't have to plug into Ariaka's own network. Give me a second to tell you how it works. So there's an Ariaka branch device. Typically, it would send customer traffic to the nearest Ariaka POP and then put that traffic on Ariaka's backbone. With this new offering, customers can just send traffic over a standard internet link, and that traffic doesn't hit Ariaka's own network. So they're positioning this for use cases like, I want to go branch to branch or branch to HQ, or I've got applications like a nightly backup that don't require the same kind of SLA or performance monitoring that I'd want on a full SD-WAN service. Or if you want to get a direct connection into software as a service app, Ariaka is giving you that option.
And also security and privacy, because keep in mind that all your traffic that trunks over Ariaka's backbone is visible to Ariaka. So if you have some high security data, maybe you don't want to be using their backbone, but you want to be using their SD-WAN capability. So it sounds like there's the case they're making here is a cost offload, so we don't have to pay for their backbone service for some subset of traffic.
Yes. Yeah, they want to keep most of the traffic on their own backbone. And that's the whole point of their backbone. They say they can treat it like a private network where they can do traffic acceleration, monitoring, all that kind of stuff that you'd want. The other thing, though, that's interesting about this hybrid WAN offering is that they say they will also do the local link procurement for you for that last mile access. They'll get the links, they'll manage the contracts, they'll monitor the performance on your behalf. So if you're not interested in having to deal with your local carriers or ISPs, they'll do it for you.
That would be interesting for some people. If you're a mid-sized company, that could be quite valuable, because managing contracts with, you know, half a dozen suppliers perhaps around where you are can be more than a little painful if you can't find a telecoms broker to do it for you.
That's right. Yeah. So we've got a link to the press release if you want to go check it out.
Yeah.
All right, some other news today. The switching ASIC maker Innovium, they had a couple of recent announcements. First, the company has introduced a new ASIC family. They're calling it Teralynx 5. They're targeting top of rack, edge, and enterprise with this. They support 10 to 400 gig ports. And Greg, you pulled this one out. This came to your attention.
Yeah, I am. I got a briefing from Innovium this week. But there's two parts to the announcement. First of all, Teralynx, which is their big 12.8 terabits ASIC, if you like.
That's the Teralynx 7, yeah.
Yeah, the Teralynx 7. They've respun the architecture, so they've come up with a version 2 of the chip. They're making fairly big statements about it being ultra-area efficient, so they've got increased the density by as much as 2 times. They've got 40 new patents in the architecture, et cetera, et cetera. So they're claiming that their innovation around ASIC design or silicon design has been dramatically improved from the Teralynx 1 to the Teralynx 2, and that applies right across their range. Now, this would make it, gives it more telemetry capabilities, more analytics capabilities, improves down the latency even further. There's making statements about buffers, you know, all the good stuff is all there, as you might imagine, in a version 2 of the chipset.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to get some, if you're an Ignition member, I'm hoping to make the slides available to you. So if you want to poke into that, but I'm just waiting for Innovium to give us some permission for that. So that's really, you know, this idea that an ASIC company has been able to re-spin their ASIC and get out a second version of the design is sort of a hallmark of the fact that they've been given a whole wadge of cash by a VC industry. We saw Barefoot disappear into Intel. The suggestion was that they ran out of cash. That I've heard the scuttlebutt was that they ran out of cash to be able to re-spin the ASIC for a second run. But Innovium is already there. So that's positive. It suggests that they're, and they made the point that Innovium has been very successful in selling their chips to Cisco in particular. So many of the Nexus 9000 chips actually run the Innovium silicon. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, and one of Innovium's benefits when it came to market is that it was a programmable ASIC, a programmable forwarding pipeline for the Teralynx 7. These new chips that they're rolling out in the Teralynx 5 family don't sound like they have a programmable forwarding pipeline, although they say that the software is programmable to the effect that you can add new routing protocols if you want.
Well, they've never been as programmable as the Barefoot Tofino.
Right, not quite.
But they're increasing where the programmability is, they're increasing the programmability functions. So, you know, better forwarding rules, better custom programmability, so forth and so on.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, as we go forward, you want to have the flexibility because you don't know what features are coming down the pipeline.
Yeah.
So that's useful suggestion is, you know, I think you'll see them continue on based on their current momentum. And they got a stonking amount of cash. It was like $100 million or something.
Uh-huh.
So that's a vote of confidence bomb somebody at least.
There's a lot of money sloshing around Silicon Valley these days, so...
Not so much after WeWork's failure this week, but, you know,
we'll see.
Something we'll talk about here. But they're also introducing a new chipset called the Teralynx 5.
Yes.
Teralynx 5 is very much a top-of-rack switch, so it's up to 128 SerDes channels, so 125 IOs off the ASIC. And interestingly about this is they're hosting both 1025 NRZ and 50 gig PAM4. So what that means is that the ASIC is actually ready for the different gearboxes as we switch up from 10/25 using NRZ encoding or non-return to zero and switch up to 50 gig, which is using PAM4, pulse amplitude modulation, four times. That's a substantial change, and the chips do need to be re-engineered to handle that. So this chip is somewhat simpler, has most of the features of the bigger Teralynxes, but is designed for the top-of-rack type solution. So we're seeing what Broadcom did, you know, eventually, once upon a time they had Trident and Tomahawk. Now they have Trident, Tomahawk, and Jericho or June. And now you have different versions in each of those chips. Some of them are cut down a little bit, and they're used for smaller applications or edge or campus type stuff. So the Teralynx is meant to be, from their point of view, would be perhaps useful in the campus or at the top of rack, but as a campus, it would be a backbone switch. And for top of rack, it would be for very high performance, 50 gig. Well, when you're running 50 gig PAMs, you're talking about 50, 100, 200, 400 gig out of a single switch, depending on how you architect.
Yeah, definitely they're positioning for top of rack. Also, they mentioned edge for those 5G use cases.
Of course they did. Everybody's got an edge 5G use case. That's like saying your donut's not made of donut these days. That's why I didn't even bother talking about it. Yeah, I'm quite positive about this. I think having a nice independent silicon, we've seen plenty of people using Broadcom, but the vendors I speak to sort of have mixed feelings about Broadcom. Their APIs aren't so great, and they don't have good support and so forth. So we'll wait to see how this pans out. But, you know, given that they've got good volume shipping to Cisco and other companies, there's hope that we might see some new silicon emerging, and there might be some competitiveness in that market. I wouldn't want to see Broadcom being the only supplier in that market.
For sure. Yeah, I'm always happy to see competition.
Yeah, and lots of form factors will come out of this. It's up to somebody else to pack it up. But, you know, 16 QSFP DDs, you know, 16 400 gig ports is quite a lot in a single switch for a Teralynx 5 in a campus backbone. Uh-huh. But it can be repackaged all the way down to 48 SFPs with 8 QSFPs. So you can have 48 25s and 8 by 100 gigs and that sort of thing. So good stuff. Good stuff. Nice progress. And hopefully I'll have those slides available for you for those people who are admission members.
And in the meantime, links are in the show notes. Amazon, they have announced a new wireless protocol called Sidewalk. It's designed to be low-power, long-distance network for IoT devices. Amazon says that Bluetooth and Wi-Fi don't have the range for all the gadgets they want to connect. This one's using the 900 megahertz spectrum. Connectivity could extend as far as 1 mile.
Yeah, can we cue some creepy music here? This corporate surveillance? Because that's what this is. This is really quite disturbing to me. But let's go through the technical details. So this is a low bandwidth network that uses the unlicensed 900 megahertz spectrum.
Yep.
And it's a low bandwidth, low power, low cost type of wireless network. And the point would be is that Amazon's going to put the radio base stations into devices that it ships out to your house. So things like your Ring door camera knob thing.
Yeah,
that
or will the be, Alexa or whatever smart home
Alexa
device.
Or something in your house will become one of the base stations for this. And because it uses unlicensed spectrum, they can just put them all around. And every time you buy one of those devices and put it in someone's house, they can build out that network, right?
Uh-huh.
So they were talking here. They went to Ring HQ for a few devices and asked, and I'm quoting here from the article, asked the team how long it would take to get an Amazon Sidewalk network up and running. We sent 700 devices out to employees, friends, and families. And 3 weeks later, we had the LA Basin, the second largest city in the US, completely covered in 3 weeks.
Wow.
Right. So you don't need to ship too many of these devices and you can cover an entire town. And then what they're able to do is if you have a little tag or a little transceiver, very low powered, lasts for 5 to 10 years with a battery, it can then track that around. So the classic application here is a dog tracker or a pet tracker. You put a little tracker onto their collar and you can see where they are within the range. And because Amazon's got the cloud network and if it's in a Ring doorbell, which is already connected to your home Wi-Fi, that network is now telling Amazon exactly where everything that you've got on the sidewalk is.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, the first product they rolled out to tie into this network was this a dog tracker. You can put a little tracker on your dog collar to see where they've wandered off to.
Yeah, so if you're into privacy at all, you might want to be looking at your Alexa devices to see if they're a sidewalk node and turn it off because effectively you're helping the surveillance. I'm a little bit worried about that. Now, we did also talk about this exact same thing, I think 2 or 3 months ago when we talked about Helium Network.
Yes, this was a startup that was combining low-power Wi-Fi or low-power mobile connectivity with, for some reason, blockchain.
Well, the blockchain was to do a proof of stake. So it was to, if you have a node on the network, so Amazon, of course, has got cloud infrastructure and, you know, devices already out there. But if you're a startup, how do you prove that someone's got a node to participate in the network? How do you charge people to be on the network, if I like, right?
Right.
So they were using blockchain to say your device is on the network and it's turned on. And so it continually processes the blockchain to show that it's there. That's all that was. Uh-huh. But Amazon's basically just killed them off, I think, because Amazon can afford to just give this away and they get data. Can you imagine sort of like them selling you a device that's got a sidewalk tag in it and then tracking what you do with that tag?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And they to that end, they also rolled out some new hardware devices, including eyeglasses, earbuds, and for some reason, a ring, an actual ring that you wear on your finger that's somehow tied into Alexa if you need to ask Alexa something out in the street.
Did you see the Alexa-controlled microwave and the electric-controlled power socket?
I did not.
Didn't see those? Gosh.
Good Lord.
Yeah, if you have a look in the link in the show notes for the Amazon Devices event, they actually the sidewalk stuff was right at the very end. And almost, but the Amazon Smart Oven, which includes an Echo Dot, get this. It's a combination microwave, convection oven, air fryer, and food warmer that you can control with your voice using compatible Alexa-enabled devices. Just ask Alexa to cook common foods using dozens of presets that have been carefully tuned and tested. And next, Alexa will announce when to stir the food during cooking and let you know when it's finished.
Oh, boy.
Yep. And just in case you're a complete incompetent, and you can scan the barcode to cook hundreds of packaged foods from your Alexa apps. The instructions automatically preload on your oven. So if you don't know how to cook frozen veggies, just scan the barcode, stick them in the microwave, and boom, Amazon's got you covered.
That's great, and I'm sure they'll be able to tie it into their delivery service as well, where if I'm running low on my frozen dinners, they'll happily ship me more.
Anyway, so yeah, very interesting. I think there is an angle here with telcos. We've talked before about LoRa and NB-IoT. I published I talked about them in a white paper again that I wrote for Ignition. Sorry to belabor the point. But these are low-powered wide area networking protocols that are standardized globally, and the telcos were supposed to be doing this. And it's very interesting to see that Amazon might get to this market first and completely take that whole revenue stream, especially in the consumer market. The commercial market will be done differently, but in the consumer market, they might just miss out on this whole low-powered WAN thing because they're just not paying attention to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Amazon has the leg up because they have devices that people want, from the doorbells to the Alexa to now dog collars and eyeglasses and et cetera.
Yeah, it is creepy because the Ring stuff, what Amazon's been doing with Ring in the US has been quite creepy. They've been encouraging police forces to put rings to tell people in the area to put them up, and then making the video from the Ring
available to the police. Yes,
available to police without anybody knowing.
Right.
On one hand, lowers costs for the police force. On the other hand, it's open to a lot of abuse. So
sure, and turns you into a local informant. That's right.
Yeah,
just what you wanted.
It's a fairly communist way to go about the surveillance.
You know,
Germany would have been pretty
exactly. Great. I was thinking, hey, the Stasi would have loved this.
Yes. Why follow them around with people? Just
get your friends and neighbors to become your surveillance infrastructure. Great.
Now, I'm sure that's not what Amazon's trying to do, but it certainly feels a bit creepy. But anyway, it's not our problem to solve today, just to raise the issue.
And there's your 5 minutes of creepy. For Friday. All right, another quick break to tell you about our other sponsor, CDN77. They are the content delivery network of choice for space agencies delivering Hubble images all around the world. They offer standalone end-to-end video processing and delivery platform called Streamflow. Streamflow serves content from 35 POPs on 5 continents with daily peaks regularly exceeding 5 terabits per second and overall network capacity of more than 14 terabits per second. There's no outsourcing. CDN77 develops and manages everything in-house, including its own DDoS protection, which is capable of mitigating and blocking any type of DOS or DDoS attack. They are also efficient. They can push 80 gigabits per second of live streaming through just one machine via server optimization. Customers also will enjoy top-rated 24/7 live chat support with in-house engineers who communicate with you in real time. You also get flexible pricing options, including pay-as-you-go or monthly plans. Get a free 14-day trial, no credit card needed, plus 40% off a first payment bonus for Packet Pushers listeners if you go to cdn77.com/packetpushers. That's cdn77.com/packetpushers, and we thank CDN for becoming a sponsor.
Yeah, I had a quick look at their service. There's some interesting things in there that differentiate them from other content delivery companies. So maybe it's worth giving them a check out. I'm not an expert in CDNs, but there was a lot of interesting features there in terms of HTTP acceleration that I thought if I get time, I probably won't, but, you know, to dive into them, yeah.
All right, back to the news. And this is sort of ties into our follow-up section. In a recent episode, we had talked about Palo Alto Networks, and I put down a marker on the prediction spreadsheet that Palo Alto would get into SD-WAN, and it looks like I'm a winner. So we got a tip from a listener to check out the transcript of Palo Alto's financial results call with analysts from earlier this September. And in the conversation, several executives described plans to actually develop an SD-WAN offering. It sounds like they're going to build it themselves, not buy it. It's going to be available as a service to license on top of their firewall platform. And of course, they're touting the ability to shunt traffic into Palo Alto's own cloud security offering called Prisma.
Prisma, yeah. So very interesting tip. I did actually have it open to read, but I didn't get to read it because the front part of it was boring and the SD-WAN part wasn't until it was much further down.
It's buried. It's buried deep. I had to do a lot of digging to find it, but it's there.
Yeah, dig it down. And it says, so I'll just give you some quotes here. As I mentioned, we spend a lot of time making sure we get our product strategy right and have highlighted where we plan to go. I hope you didn't miss the fact that Lee is committed publicly to deploying a lot of subscriptions to our firewall and potentially applying SD-WAN across every form factor, which makes you think like, competitively, why aren't they going to go and buy one? And they say here that I don't see a single competitor that does both the application security part of it, the firewall side of it, the CASB side of it, and the SD-WAN part of it. They are back to the corporate side of it. I just don't see anyone who has a complete portfolio to do what we're talking about. excuse me.
He's a little choking there.
Oh, gosh. Sorry.
You know, it is an analyst call. They do have to do a little fluffing.
A little? That is a big one. I mean, like, who else out there, like, you know, there's a whole bunch of companies out there who have entire security products. So if you look, Open Systems, who's a client of ours, Cato Network, Cisco Systems, of course, has all of those. It's true that Cisco hasn't unified them together in a single product offering, but hey, you know, let's not worry about that.
Details.
Fortinet doesn't have all of it. And they do particularly talk about Fortinet a lot. And they also had a bit of a joke about VMware. Every time the analysts ask them about how they're positioned against VMware's VeloCloud, they just pretend that VMware wasn't what was that? I can't hear you. So it was quite a different sort of an investor's caller. And then later on, they actually the CTO said, "No, I want to be absolutely clear. We are going to build our own SD-WAN." Mm-hmm. Now, so Nir Zuck, who's the chief technology officer. Quote, it says, and I quote, "Do I need to acquire? No, like Lee said, we're building SD-WAN." So they're planning on building it. I think this is sort of them buckling under. They have to follow the market in this case. Palo Alto was one of the first companies to build an application firewall that had some decent analytics and decent visibility. Mm-hmm. That's really the core of their strategy. Financially, they're pretty strapped. They have to grow. They're spending nearly 80% of revenues on sales and marketing, so they're not making a profit, but that's okay. They're still growing very well. That's still a viable business model today.
Yeah.
And I think they see SD-WAN as a good way to draw through sales into the Prisma, so their cloud security offering, how you send it off to be scanned and stuff like that. So they definitely need to do it. I suspect the reason that they're building SD-WAN is that they don't think it's very hard.
Yes.
And I would speculate that they're doing what other first-generation SD-WAN companies did, where they go out and buy literally license an operating system from somebody like Sixwind, buy a deep packet inspection from somebody, you know, buy a tail, you know, go to TailF and get the SNMP and the Yang engine, you know, and the CLI and all that sort of stuff. So they won't have to do a lot of work to actually get a first generation product. And then if the product gets off the ground, then they can start to work out whether they're going to develop all that in-house and generate their own code or continue to rebadge somebody else's code. If they're going to lean into the security features, they might want to trivialize the networking capabilities, if that makes sense, and lean into the security as a feature.
Yeah, absolutely. Reading through the transcript, they were really downplaying the network capability of sending traffic across multiple links. They said that's not hard. It should be easy for us to do. Our real value proposition here is the high degree of security we can apply to the traffic. So, of course, they would go with their strengths, yes.
Yeah, play to your strengths, you know. Yep. If your only tool's a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yes.
But, I mean, the point would be is that Palo Alto has been a very popular product. There's a lot of incumbent relationships with customers. And the challenge here is going to be that customers who buy SD-WAN that has security integrated, that is also mixing up things like identity management and remote access VPNs, which silo are you selling to? So I've learned over the years that vendors will tell you, you know, we could make a product that could unify all these together. But the problem is when we go out to sell it, when you go and talk to the campus people about identity and try and sell them SD-WAN, they say, well, that's a WAN product. We'll go and talk to the WAN team. The WAN team says, well, that's got identity management in it. You'll have to involve, you know, or you've got firewalls on the WAN, on the rack. Well, we'll have to get the security team. And then they argue over whose budget is, right?
Yes.
So the challenge, so for this, for them to take a security-centric approach and attempt to say to people, well, you're running firewalls now, let's do SD-WAN and treat it like remote access, then that's a viable strategy. Certainly Fortinet seems to have done fairly well with that and got a bit of an edge out of Palo Alto here.
They have, yes.
So it'd be interesting to see how they make it work.
Yeah, those corporate distinctions really matter when you're trying to make a sale because of budgets and the way the organizations are siloed. But I think part of the way that Palo Alto plans to get around this is making SD-WAN essentially a licensable feature. So for an add-on, just flip on this license control key and you got it. So that may reduce the friction internally about who gets to decide whether to turn it on.
Yeah.
And frankly, they've got a lot of campus and branch real estate with their either virtual or hardware firewall appliances. So they're well positioned in that regard.
Yeah, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out for them. I think, again, this isn't innovation. This is following the market.
Yeah.
SD-WAN is taking away firewalls completely. There are plenty of companies out there who actually just say the whole SD-WAN is a security system and should be treated like one.
Right. We see SD-WAN vendors positioning the SD-WAN appliance as your router and your firewall and your SD-WAN device. Yeah.
Look at the Open System shows where they basically started from being a SOC, a security operations control center, and realized that if they took their software and put it into the router at the edge of the network, they could actually build a much better secure system. And that's what they did. They have a SOC, they have virus scanning, AV, cloud security servers, and we've had them on plenty of shows. So go and listen to those if you want to understand what it looks like to integrate, you know, build a integrated security SD-WAN, not try and slap a firewall at the edge of the network.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll wait and see how it works out, but I think it's going to be much harder than they are making out here. But like I said, they are running on a knife edge. They need to grow. It was about 6 months ago they had a big hit to their share price when they didn't make their numbers. They are heavily geared into selling and growing. They aren't profitable yet. So they need to keep delivering for that to work out. They can't make a mistake.
Yeah. And we've got another vendor to add to our ever-expanding list of SD-WAN competitors.
Yes, it's going to be I predict 2020 will be the year of SD-WAN. Pretty safe, mate.
I think so. All right, some more news for you. IT vendors are getting less revenue from selling compute, storage, and switches for the cloud. This is according to new data from IDC. The analyst firm says revenue for public and private cloud sales both dropped 10% compared to this quarter last year. IDC expects a full year decline of 2.1%.
So that's reasonable to expect that the public clouds are looking at a recession in spending and or they can easily wind it back up in a quarter.
Yeah.
So I think the public clouds have got really efficient procurement and deployment capabilities. And so if there's a, they can see a decline coming, they can scale back their acquisitions and scale back their CapEx really quickly. And then if they see it picking up, I think they can turn it back on rapidly, without having long lag time. So, and that would also suggest that the cloud companies have either bought too much, they've got too much excess capacity, or they're expecting a slowdown later in the year. That would match the, so whichever hypothesis, I'm much more into the, I think they've got both. I think they've built too much capacity and people aren't consuming it because the price is very high and a lot of companies going into the cloud and then coming back out again. Not for, you know, there's some stuff comes back. And I also noticed in these results that when you add up branded and unbranded sales for IT infrastructure, did you see the note? I'll put it there in the notes. If you take Dell, HPE, Cisco, and Lenovo and add up their total sales, then compare it with OEM and others. So I'll just rough these numbers out for you. There's about $6 billion in a quarter from the branded vendors. There's about $7.5 billion for non-branded or others.
Yes.
So the branded vendors aren't winning here. So the idea that your Dell, HPE, Cisco, Lenovo's are actually winning, that's not what's happening. The OEM vendors are substantially larger than the vendors that you might think. I think that's very telling. I think there's a signal in there that, you know, the legacy, the idea that you buy from a brand is probably fading away for some markets. In the enterprise where we are and you and I are, that's probably true, but it's not. It does mean that the hold on the market or the ability for people like Dell and Cisco to take the market in a given direction, that's fading away as the clouds make the running.
Yeah, I think particularly at the hyperscale level, they can work very easily with OEMs and ODMs. They don't have to go to the Dells, the Ciscos of the world to get what they need. So I'm frankly not surprised to see this. I would say, yes, it's kind of stunning to see that OEM and others is outpacing the branded vendors, but there's also lots and lots of OEMs and others in that category. So it's they're splitting up the pie among more players than the branded vendors are.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. Just that shift, like once upon a time, you would never have thought of buying...
You know, yes, that the hold the branded vendors have on that, that cloud market is slipping, we'll say.
Yeah, yeah. So they're substantially, you know, less than half. They're not that much smaller, but it is a shift considering that, you know, a while ago, I doubt you would have seen this. So,
One point that jumped out to me, while public cloud sales have dropped, IDC did note that private cloud sales went up for the quarter 1.5% year over year. I'm starting to hear little rumors and rumblings about repatriation of cloud applications, a little bit of maybe disillusionment with the public cloud. I don't know that that's going to be a substantial trend, but I don't know if this is related, this little uptick in private cloud sales with those feelings of let's try to bring some of this back on premise.
Yeah, this isn't that's not an anti-cloud sentiment. I think it's more of a reality. I saw a slide published this week from IDC, which suggested 85% of companies have experienced some form of cloud repatriation, as they call it. I'll put that in the show notes because it came out as a tweet, so it's public-ish.
Yeah, it's a tweet.
Yeah, there you go. So I'll drop that in there. There you go. IDC is reporting 85% of customers report cloud repatriation activities. And if you break it down, they're saying something like, you know, some of it comes back to on-prem cloud, some of it goes back to hosted private cloud. I can't actually tell you what the difference is. But I think there's still plenty of stuff moving to the cloud. We're seeing some stuff come back from the cloud, some stuff that was developed in the cloud, and the complexity of cloud, and especially cloud billing, makes it much easier just to bring it back in-house. If you're not actually using some of the advanced services in the cloud, maybe you just don't need it, right?
Right.
You're not bursting and you're not on the leading edge and continually sucking up new services like Amazon Sidewalk and maybe you don't want to do that.
Yeah, that's right. All right, just a couple more stories before we wrap. Cloudflare, Google Chrome, and Firefox are adding HTTP/3 support.
This is interesting. So very quickly, basically, we've been talking about HTTP/3 for some time. We saw HTTP/2 announced a while ago. And now the browsers have actually announced that they're shipping it. Chrome is actually out today with HTTP/3 as we record this. It's Friday, the 27th of September. And Firefox is also shipping it in its latest version. Cloudflare has announced that its proxies or its content delivery network is going to handle it. So that means they'll terminate HTTP/3 and send HTTP whatever to your site. It's the first step in a larger rollout. Two two or three key features for you. HTTP3 supports session tracking. So as you roam between networks, so if you're logged onto a website and you are on Wi-Fi, and then you go onto 5G, and then you roam onto a 3G network, normally you would have three times because your IP address would change as you jump between the networks. HTTP3 creates a session cookie so that as you move around, the server would be able to not have to keep reinitializing state. Can also track you, but yep, that's a trade-off.
Win some, you lose some.
Yep, TLS over UDP. So what you're seeing is the end of TCP, which started some time ago. But this is like full support for TLS over UDP, which probably means if you're an enterprise company, you're going to start to see some weird traffic on your firewalls. So if you're not allowing UDP through your firewalls on port 443, which is possible, you might start to see some weird traffic increasing. And it also has an encrypted SNI. Now, this is a bit more problematic. By encrypting the name of the server that you're going to in the header and hiding it, a lot of application detection is done by looking for the brand domain name in the certificate, in the crypto certificate. And by encrypting that, some application inspection may stop working. So firewalls, application firewalls, SD-WAN could be impacted here.
Yeah,
haven't had a chance to follow up and find out if that's a problem and why. Maybe I'll do a blog post on that. But yeah, I think it's a step forward. At the end of the day, the challenge here is that because of all the middle boxes in the internet, any innovation that we could do on TCP was broken. We couldn't do it. So I agree with most of the industry that the shift to UDP means we can now do some innovation in HTTP. And now HTTP4 can have new flow control algorithms or add new features without having the TCP protocols screwing things up.
And you've got a link to an APNIC blog that has more details about that.
Yeah, the APNIC blog gets into some of the performance improvements and their actual testing.
UDP versus TCP, you're saying?
Yeah, whether HTTP over UDP or HTTP over TCP is actually faster or slower. Their conclusion is that performance gains that they talked about in the early days might have been obviated by new TCP algorithms. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. What we need is to get away from TCP for speed. UDP is faster than TCP for now. Maybe by switching to TCP, people will take their stupid middle boxes out.
I wouldn't count on it.
Yeah.
Our last story for the day. Last week, we reported that the tech company Chef decided to stick with existing contracts with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Department, or ICE, despite internal protests from employees and open source contributors over ICE policies such as family separation. I think the day we published the show, Chef actually released a new memo from the CEO saying the company had reversed position. It says it will allow its contract with ICE to expire. It will not renew it. They're also going to donate the equivalent amount of the 2019 value of that contract to charities that support those families affected by family separation policies. And the company says it's going to develop an ethics policy to systematically, quote, evaluate potentially problematic customer contracts, end quote.
Good response, once forced to it. But the thing that I can't get over here is if you're an open source company and you're relying on other people to give you code to make your product fly, right? And keep in mind, they're giving code back as well. So there's a quid pro quo here.
Yeah.
But if you're building a community in open source and you're relying on people to contribute your code so that you can extract money from it, and this is always the tension in open source, those people contributing code will often have very strong ethics and morals about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
They're the sort of person who'll give, you know, unpaid hours of their life to contributing to something that they believe in. So how could a CEO of a company like Chef not comprehend this and just sit there and say, money, we sold it, it's our money, now get out of the way, which is basically the summary of their first letter, and now have to suck it up and go, after deep introspection and dialogue within Chef, we will, you know, hello, sweetheart, that's not how it works.
Yeah, so part of the issue with the whole Chef thing is that some of the code they relied on was open source and the developer behind it pulled it from GitHub. And so Chef had some customer impacting events because of that. I've got a link in the show notes about how they worked around it. But they started pissing off the open source community in part because of the politics of this, but also because of the way they treated this developer. So it seems like there's a new risk profile emerging around open source. It used to be people worried about, is it secure, or what happens if people stop supporting this code? Now you've also got to start to consider potentially the political inclinations of contributors.
I think so. And predictable. And the CEO of an open source company should know this. This isn't, do you know what I'm saying? Like, the disconnect between this, the CEO making, you know, just completely going like, well, we're making money, what else is wrong with this, in an open source community is really out of touch, and quite would suggest that something's not right at the top of Chef.
I, I don't know that I would say something's not right at the top. I feel like CEOs tend to have a different perspective. I don't know anything about the CEO, so this is all speculation. I'm guessing he didn't come up through the open source community. If you're a CEO, you tend to come from the business side of things, and so that would be his perspective. He's just had some significant cultural education, though, over the past couple of weeks.
It just, you know, it's one of these things that if you're in the VC community or if you're running a startup like Chef is, the pressure to make money and to grow is just, you know, very, very high. But at the same time, to lose focus with your customers and your stakeholders is just as much a failure.
Yeah, there's a lot of trends going on here. We're seeing a lot more social activism from employees inside organizations wanting their company to do the right thing, whatever that thing is. We're seeing more companies rely on open source projects, and so now they've got to account potentially for these kinds of things happening. So we're in very interesting times.
And also for you as a person working in enterprise IT, if you've got strong morals and ethics, you need to be thinking about your position in these sorts of things, perhaps, as we said in the last show. But let's not belabor it. Good luck. Well done to Chef for turning it around and making a purse out of a pig's ear.
Right. Well done. All right, that wraps up the news portion of the show. Please stay tuned for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Arista Networks. We're going to be talking about software quality and security. As Greg mentioned, it's an interesting conversation with Doug Gourlay, so hang around. That's starting right now. You're listening to Tech Bytes, a short, sharp, sponsored conversation where we grab a hold of a technology or concept and see how much juice we can squeeze out of it in about 15 minutes. Our sponsor today is Arista Networks, and we're going to talk about how software quality and product integrity delivers value to customers. Our guest is Doug Gourlay. He is VP and General Manager of Cloud Networking at Arista. Doug, welcome to the show. Arista is known as a networking company, a lot of hardware. Why are we talking about software?
Well, I mean, software is what makes networks reliable. When you really get down to it, network reliability is the a priori number one first principle of networking, period. What makes networks reliable? Great software. Software that's designed to fail. Software that's designed to be tested. Software that's designed to be automated. Software that takes repeatable, scalable patterns and allows us to reproduce them across our enterprise, data center, campus, wherever, and in turn deliver reliable outcomes to clients, whether it's apps or data or people or devices. So, yes, comes back down to software.
It does. So do you say that software is more often a problem than hardware? We know that power supplies flame out and line cards fail and transceivers have bad days. Would you say that software is as big as or more than a big as problem than that?
Absolutely, Greg. And when you really get down to it, a hardware failure is almost always an isolated incident, right? Like an optic failed, a fan tray failed, a chassis exploded into flames mysteriously.
Yeah.
A thermal event, I hear it called. When that happens... That's an isolated event. That device went down.
The blast radius is small. It's limited to the device. Yeah, yeah.
By the way, when that goes down, what corrects it?
What? The software, of course. Yeah.
Right. The routing protocol, the software, that implementation is what detects the fault and works around it. Similarly, if I screw up a routing protocol, what's the blast radius of that? Oops, there went your entire infrastructure. Have a nice day.
But the flip side of this is that software can be breached, right? So not only does it mean that software has to be reliable and stable and do what it needs to be, but it can also be perturbated by external events. You can have it so that somebody hacks it or sends it a magic packet and causes the router to reboot. Those are equally part of the reliability phase.
So fundamentally, in the last decade, we've watched network operating systems go primarily from what historically were monolithic proprietary OSs altogether to using a Linux substrate, right? It's the most common OS used in IT, but specifically within networking, whether a BSD Unix derivative or Linux derivative. And the outcome of that is that we're using libraries like SSHD, you know, and those libraries often have defects in software code that are being exploited by bad actors.
Yeah.
We also see a significant increase in the last 5 years of nation-state-sponsored threat actors attacking the critical infrastructure of their adversaries. Now, what is critical infrastructure? You know, utilities, hospitals, pension funds, banking systems, right? Municipalities that are doing smart grids, criminal justice systems. Well, what do they depend on? Networks. Right?
Yeah.
So the network is part of the attack surface that these threat actors are going against. And the network, because it does touch everything, is a wonderful place to insert, land and expand, laterally expand through the infrastructure, and compromise significant amounts of systems. But now, as we said, the networks have started using Linux-based systems. So the number of attacks against it increased dramatically, the number of shared libraries used, and we've watched the increase in the complexity of these networks grow also. With increasing complexity is absolutely the opportunity for vendors to have vulnerabilities and exploits, which are defined as mistakes in software code.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing here is that we've seen a lot of problems with certain vendors announcing like streams of bugs lately. And I'm not sure whether there's been a real tick up of, you know, maybe people are starting to attack networking devices more, or whether the vendors themselves are starting to do more testing, or whether there's a focus from security researchers to actually say, if I look at common networking devices, I'm starting to see a lot more CVEs being announced. So CVE is a common vulnerability exposure. It's a standard for announcing, you know, that a vulnerability has been detected. But we've seen a string of CVEs, particularly around Nexus 9000, which we've talked about on the Network Break a lot. Is that symptomatic of something, or is that something that Arista is addressing? Do you see that as something that Arista can solve?
Well, I mean, back to the definition, it's a mistake in software code, right? So a mistake in software code can be addressed, and I'd like to think as a vendor we've addressed it for what we're responsible for, which is our operating systems, and that's through significant investments in test and test automation, hiring security researchers to proactively go against your systems in a black box, gray box, and white box scenario to identify issues before they go into the wild, and then remediate them. Additionally, software architecture, because are defects going to happen? They are. Everybody has bugs, period.
Yeah.
Do some of those defects result in the ability for a threat actor to create remote code execution or privilege escalate? They will. And when that happens, any vendor can have a vulnerability. The next piece is, how do you deal with that vulnerability? Okay, so this, you mentioned CVEs. And within the CVE, there's a CVSS score, which is a rating of criticality, right? And that rating is based on a variety of things, but along the lines of how widespread it is, how easy it is to execute. Can I execute remotely or far away? And what is the impact of me doing it? Mm-hmm. And so it comes down to understanding these CVSS scores of the CVEs that affect the devices I have in my estate, and then making a determination as to how quickly should I remediate them. Because when they happen, what we need to do as an industry, that your vendor needs to report it, or it's reported against them. Then a ticking time bomb starts, right? It's how quickly can I remediate it?
So what you're alluding to there is there's two problems. One is that the bug happens at all, or that the vulnerability occurs at all. It shouldn't occur. Some of the vulnerabilities we've seen lately around certain switches is just like, do they actually gotten me questioning, do they actually test them at all? Or is it literally just a schoolboy checking in some code to get so he can go home and chase after girls in the evening sort of thing? But the flip side of what you...
That is a cultural issue in that organization. Absolutely.
Yeah, and we've seen, you know, there are some organizations that just seem to publish out streams of vulnerabilities. And I genuinely questioned it on various parts. But I think the flip side of what you're talking about here is, look, they are going to happen. And the other side of it is that I've got to have absolute trust that if I patch the operating system or update the operating system in some way, that the update will also work. And so if I've got a system which is weak and vulnerable, and if I upgrade it, am I questioning myself, is it going to work as I planned? I need to have full faith that the vendor has fixed the bug and that I can fit the software and know that it's going to work as promised. I don't have to sort of cross my fingers and hope it still works after I've done the upgrade.
Right. The more that you trust that vendor's code quality, the easier that vendor makes it to execute that upgrade without causing an outage, the easier that vendor proactively notifies you through, you know, automated methods, including their management systems, and the easier that vendor makes it through automated workflows to deploy those hot fixes or those upgrades, all of those conspire to compress that response window down so that a customer can be confident that if there is a critical vulnerability, they can remediate it with compensating controls, generally within 24 hours, and upgrade within 1 week on an emergency change control, preferably without causing any systems outage.
Yeah.
Right? And that's kind of the
standard. So I should be able to do the upgrade and know that it's going to go and not feel a sense of nervousness, or I'm going to have to be by the phone all weekend in the hope that nothing barfs because I had to patch it.
Well, and think about that, Greg, from what the vendor had to do once they discovered this defect. They had to receive the defect, understand it, remediate it, fix it, and then do hopefully a full test cycle.
Right.
Now, this is where vendors run into problems. If the vendor has not implemented full test automation into their environment, what you end up getting is code that is circumspect. And this either delays the release, which increases your exposure, or you get a supposed fix and it breaks other things because it was only regression tested against the components that supposedly changed.
So how much responsibility is on the customer when they get an upgrade or an updated software package from their vendor to do their own testing and work to figure out whether this is going to break something when they upgrade, when they patch?
This is a vendor confidence question. Right. And I mean, I know it was comical. I was explaining what a CVE and CVSS was to a friend's company. And I'm like, so how long, tell me what your normal upgrade procedures are. They're like, well, we've had some switches that have been in for 9 years and have not been upgraded once. They're still running. They've never been rebooted. They're running the same code. I'm like, oh. And he said, and on the average, we upgrade about once every 18 to 24 months to a new OS version for our data center switches. I'm like, guys, do you realize the exposure? And they did not realize it. I think that, by the way, shame on whoever their vendor is for not having integrated full visibility into the vulnerabilities they're exposing their clients to through their management platforms in their OS. I mean, that is absolutely appalling.
Yeah. But it costs a lot of money too, right? If you're going to download the code from a vendor and then put it into a test lab and validate that it works and then put it out in a pilot project to see if it doesn't cause any buffs inside of your network, that costs a lot of money. And I think certain vendors are actually saying, you know, you should do your own testing. You should validate it yourself in your own lab. I think that's entirely unreasonable. If I've paid a premium price for a product from a branded vendor, I should not have to do my own testing. I should be able to just go with full confidence and say, this product is premium, ready to go. I don't expect to buy a Ferrari and then have to wait for it to break down in the next 10 minutes sort of thing.
I agree with you, Greg. And I think it's probably important to understand not only what the type of change control remediation plan and policy an enterprise should adopt to minimize their threat, but then also what that actual exposure looks like in the industry, right? So like, how many of these events are there? And what should I plan for, right? And think, getting ahead of it and actually creating a plan of how often you would have to upgrade by network operating system or by what your estate and landscape looks like gives you an idea of the type of financial controls any enterprise that spends a reasonable amount of money and budget should be putting into their enterprise agreements to hold their vendors accountable for these types of events.
Yeah. There's a real cost associated. It's not just like, you know, oh, I have to do an update. That's actually dollars and cents attached to that. It's not free, you know.
The difference, you know, I mean, we can look at a network with just 500 devices. And, you know, without calling the vendor name out, I would say that the annual operating expense, if you actually remediated every CVE that was released against their four major operating systems in the transport space in the last year, it would have cost $7.7 million if it was $250 per device to upgrade it. And that doesn't account for testing, deployment, installation, just taking a simple
$250 per device. This is truck rolls, remote access, somebody sitting there on the SSH console doing the copy TFTP, blah, 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 right?
Yeah. That's a low estimate.
All this ties back to the initial notion of software design. If the software is not designed for upgrades or for the anticipation of failure, that's a problem. And I think we're seeing this in that newer network operating systems are coming out with modular microservices architectures so that you can upgrade components without having to wipe the entire OS and start over.
Well, and I'll give you an example. Aristas had security advisories based on software bill of materials, items, you know, libraries we used that have identified defects within them. Okay. We found them or they were found. We openly acknowledged it. We notified every customer and it's integrated into our management tool as well. I'll just take the last 10 as an example. Seven of the last 10 were in user space. So we were able to issue our clients complete hot fixes that had no disruption whatsoever to the operations of the system. Three of the 10 were in kernel space. That's a little bit harder, but because they were generally based on things like malformed packets from specific addressing or, you know, addresses or targeting specific ports, we were able to, again, implement hotfixes into the kernel using like IP tables rules that allowed us to, again, have an immediate compensating control and remediation of that risk with no outage. And that's 10 for 10 for the last 10 software bill of materials security advisories we've had, not getting into CVEs. And CVEs, again, being a mistake in our code that we're, right. Here they are. And for those, we'd have to get into what the numbers are by vendor.
Hmm. So let's just put this into perspective, Doug. How many CVEs has Arista had by comparison, say, to your leading vendor, leading vendor in the networking space? What's the sort of relative numbers here? Because we all know, we're all taught to jump this high and expect that bugs and vulnerabilities will happen. And when they happen, we have to suck it up and make good. So what is Arista's numbers here?
As of a couple of weeks ago, for the last 5 years, Arista had 3 vulnerabilities total. One was a 10. It was a critical. One was highly rated, and one was moderate. By comparison, Cisco's NXOS, which I think would use as our leading competitor, was 128. iOS was 217. iOS XC, if I remember right, was 201.
Yeah. Now those numbers are true to people in the audience who are listening. We've called these out on the Network Break podcast several times over the last few months and sort of highlighted the fact that this seems to be a recurring issue. So I'm very sensitive to this, and people are telling us that it's costing them a substantial amount of time and effort to be constantly patching these or remediating these devices or to cop the risk, right? So Doug's not exaggerating here. This is even apocryphally, just by watching what's happening, those are genuinely true. A couple of 100 vulnerabilities over the last 2-3 years is real.
Yeah, and if you take a 5-year deployment, you would look at, on average, if I'm a all Cisco shop, about 41 emergency upgrades you'd have to do over the last 5 years, and that's one emergency upgrade every 6 weeks, and about 270 monthly upgrades, within a one high vulnerability issue. So you'd have an upgrade about every week. So, I mean, bluntly, an enterprise customer should plan on one emergency change control a week against at least 25% to 30% of their networking plant.
And that's just to sustain
vulnerabilities and threats. It's growing 15.5% a year, actually.
Right. And that's just to sustain the existing network. That's not including the changes you would have to make for ads, moves, and changes to put new stuff in, to progress forward, to add new features. You would just spend, yeah. I think, over 5 years, 5 years is, 250 weeks, 270 accelerated upgrades. You're saying that's your change window every week. That's your failure budget for any given week.
You are in pain avoidance and threat mitigation 100% of your operational lifetime.
Well, I think that's probably where we should wrap it up, because that is an astonishing conclusion.
Well, thank you, Doug, for joining us, and we thank Arista for being a sponsor. If folks want to find out more about Arista, you can just go to arista.com. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.